I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. So there's a lot of discussion about pipelines, the politics of pipelines and the sort. So to help me at least understand all of this, I've asked Kindagata over to talk about what's in store for the next year and beyond when it comes to energy policy and the environment. There's also concerns over media literacy on issues surrounding all of it, and Mr. Nagata would be an ideal person to help us wade through it, as he's an environmentalist and a journalist. Just before Christmas, the Joint Review Panel recommended that, subject to 209 recommendations, the federal government approve Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline project. We'll talk about that and more. Mr. Nagata is a videographer, writer, and satirist. He was a journalist with the CBC in Montreal, radio and television, and the former CTV Quebec City bureau chief. His website is at kainagata.com, and satire can be found at deepprogram.com. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in studio, Kainagata. Mr. Nagata, good morning.
Hey, Joseph. Good to be back.
Thanks for joining us. One of the things that got me to arrange this was some of the stuff that I'd seen written on your website, some of the tweets that you've been writing on this. I guess first is the back and forth that you had with Ezra Levant on Christmas. I guess it was Christmas Day, wasn't it?
I believe it was December 25th.
Yeah. So you had written a piece on the Desmog blog.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess Ezra has a problem with that blog.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of imputing motives as to what their purpose is and who they're funded by. First of all, to the piece that you wrote there, I guess he read it and he said that you're anti-oil. And then the next morning he tweets, and then you had this back and forth on Christmas Day, which I thought was a neat way to celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, well, it was certainly very festive. I think that it's simplistic to say that I'm anti-oil. I recognize the reality that our economy and our society depend on it, but I'm talking about oil exports and sending unrefined crude or natural gas out of the country at the rates dictated by the shippers and the customers overseas, which we don't have a lot of control over. So I think rather than call myself an environmentalist, I'm somebody who is interested in how facts inform the discussion and the debate on both sides, and what the decisions are of citizens when they're well informed, and how we can make responsible decisions based on what the majority of us want instead of whoever has the loudest voice or the most money to shove ads down our throat.
And so when he was talking about I guess he wasn't saying that you're being paid off by
Well, he was. He was saying that I work for the Tides Foundation out of San Francisco, and that they dictate what I say, which is funny because I've never had any contact or received any money from the Tides Foundation, but he pointed to some of the sources of funding of this blog, which hosted an article that they asked me to write. And so whether that makes me like a paid operative of the U.S. refineries or whatever the logic is behind that, I don't know how far or how deep the conspiracy extends, but I'm happy to clarify if you have any other questions about who pays me and where I write and who funds them, if I can answer.
Well, Ezra can ask you if he's that interested. But we do see a lot of this online. People mm-hmm. ask if there's an op-ed critical of, say, the pipeline,
mm-hmm.
Automatically people like Ezra Levant will go on Twitter and dismiss it.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of what's in it, but because of say, these business connections or whatever.
So Ezra Levant is also the chairman of Ethical Oil, a group that's never disclosed the source of its own funding. There's a bit of a double standard at play here, and I think when you have outlets that, like the Taiyi, I'm an associate editor, the Taiyi.ca, and, for specific reporting projects in the past, the Taiyi Solutions Society has applied for grants to foundations in Canada. And so if Tides Canada provides funding to do some reporting around the oil sands, that's considered a reason not to credit the information that's in that article. But nobody looks at a mainstream newspaper and says, well, you just do what your advertisers tell you to do. And, I read The Walrus, and every month there's a two-page Enbridge ad mm-hmm. inside the front leaf. There's car ads, there's cosmetic ads, nobody would seriously suggest that the Vancouver Sun or the Globe and Mail are not credible, or their journalists are just paid by the advertisers who fund the reporting they do. So I think it's a little bit problematic to assume that facts are invalid and the discussion can't be had because of where an outlet has gotten funding in the past, if that includes foundations.
Is that all that side has, say, in terms of arguing?
No, I mean, you also have newspapers where you have, you know, fellows from think tanks that we know now from tax returns in the U.S. have been funded by industrialists and oil companies in the States. The Fraser Institute is a good example. That doesn't mean I disregard out of hand everything that the Fraser Institute produces. Presumably they have some sort of firewall, some sort of academic independence between their funding and, you know, what they say in public. And I'm willing to debate the facts and to look seriously at what Ezra says, or Vivian Krauss for that matter. But I think that it's an unfortunate move to try to shut down the debate in the first place on the basis of, you know, where you think the money comes from.
So Neil Young waded into all of this this past week in an interview with Gian Gomeshi on CBC.
Mm-hmm.
The initial reaction to all of it was this, that why are we listening to a celebrity tell us about public issues and the sort? And then there was some talk about his music, which I found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But really, because of who he is and what he said. I mean, I listened to the interview, and I didn't find him terribly articulate. And I think I was quoted on Twitter on a CBC story that after listening to it, he said that we either have to decide whether he's right or Harper and sort mm-hmm. of the multinationals are right. At this point, I'm undecided.
You didn't come away from that discussion any better informed.
No.
But the idea of attacking the source of the ideas rather than debating the ideas themselves is the same problem we've seen. And the irony, I don't know if you know Charlie Damaris, the
right.
Eastman comic, but he tweeted something I thought was pretty on the nose yesterday.
Quite
saying,
funny, yeah.
Corporations bend over backwards to get celebrity endorsements, but the minute they say something out of line, they're just some dumb rock star. And, of course, you know, they're considered to be authorities on Pepsi or, you know, Neutrogena skin wash or a certain car until they say something that's, you know, out of line with the interests of a small cabal of very powerful industrialists. And suddenly it's, you know, it's just some ex-druggy rock star hypocrite who isn't entitled to hold those opinions. Now, I will say about Neil Young, my family's Japanese-Canadian, and I don't think Fort McMurray looks like Hiroshima. That was hyperbole, but it's a rhetorical device and an opinion that he's entitled to use. And so I disagree with him on the substance of that, but I thought that he provoked an interesting debate, and as we found out from polls on the websites of newspapers like the Edmonton Journal, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of Albertans actually agreed with him that the pace of development was out of control and that something had to be done to remediate some of the land that's been sacrificed for that economic development.
So what do you make of how these stories have been covered in the news? And especially like the Neil Young thing. I listened to a thing on Friday morning on Q where they were fact-checking what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But then it sort of devolved into a conversation about whether someone like him should be talking about this. We've gone, say, on the other side of what...
Well, it's always ironic to hear journalists say, you know, they waste ink and page space or airtime saying, should we be giving this person oxygen?
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're doing. When you decide to cover somebody because they're famous or because what they say is wacky, then you're absolutely putting the resources at your disposal and the money of your advertisers and the infrastructure to work pushing that person's ideas wider and wider. So if that becomes the conversation, then nobody should be surprised. I will say that as a former mainstream journalist, one thing that really, you know, moves viewers to your website or gets people to listen to a radio show is controversy, and controversy can be polarizing. Nobody wants to listen to two reasonable middle ground people, you know, discuss ideas. That doesn't sell newspapers. So what you get naturally is a market where the sort of loudest and loopiest people representing both sides of a debate end up taking up most of the airtime, and then everybody wrings their hands when the discussion seems simplistic or polarized or hyperbolic or out of control, and that's just a natural function of people needing to move eyeballs to their website or to get viewers or listeners to tune in to their broadcast. So
if you and Ezra got into a fight, who would win?
Well, I've actually offered that,
like
to
a physical
him.
Something physical.
Well,
yeah.
He kept trying to get me on his show, and I just said, "Well, that's kind of your turf, right?
Yeah.
You can literally turn my microphone down if you don't like what I'm saying. It just doesn't seem like it helps anybody. It might generate some viewership, and you know, if I said something really crazy and they could get a lot of mileage out of the video, then it would drive some web traffic, and you know, it could help Sun TV. But I don't really see how it helps my aims, and I don't see how it advances the conversation to have this kind of public sparring match on television. So I made the point that if you want me to come on your show, I'll do that, but you have to come to East Van and spend 3 minutes in the octagon with me, and we'll do a televised UFC match for charity, and we can do exactly what Patrick Brazzo and Justin Trudeau did, but with MMA rules, and then we'll raise a bunch of money for the charity of our choice, and the winner gets to, you know, he can give it to Ethical Oil, and I'll give it to whoever, the Dogwood Initiative.
And his response was?
He didn't respond, so we're at an impasse, and I still haven't gone on his show.
Yeah. In terms of what we've been hearing in the news in recent weeks and days, the Northern Gateway, the pipeline, I mentioned it in the introduction. The Joint Review Panel has advised the government, I guess, that they should approve it pending these conditions, these recommendations. Mm-hmm. Apparently, by the way, these recommendations, some of them are, there's 209, but not all of them are serious, right? I mean, they're all serious, but they're not.
They're of varying degrees of challenge, I think, and some of them have already been addressed by modifications in the proposal, and some of them are a bit vague, but all of them sound doable, and the company says that they're pretty confident they can check off all 209.
So this will, I mean, just looking at it sort of objectively, this will happen, right? It's just a question of when?
Well, it's up to the cabinet, and, you know, I really don't like predicting the future. I think that we get it wrong most of the time. One thing that's been pointed out is that of all the pipeline projects to come up for approval first by the federal cabinet, under the new rules that they themselves created, this is politically the most unpredictable. Northern Gateway is the project that has created the most animosity and attracted the most opposition from not only the official opposition in Ottawa, the Liberal Party as well, but, you know, 130 First Nations in BC, the Union of BC Municipalities, the province of British Columbia, and a majority of the citizens. So it seems like if this were the pipeline, just politically, it's the one that stands to do them the most damage at this point. And approving it, you know, the federal cabinet have shown before that they factor politics into their decisions very heavily. And they have an election to try to win, and they have 21 seats to try to hang on to in BC in 2015. So there's a question of whether that decision could be delayed or whether it could be sent back down to the NEB for further review to push the timeline back a little bit, or whether they might sacrifice Northern Gateway and throw Enbridge under the bus in order to put leverage behind another alternate proposal or another pipeline, be that to Vancouver or to another direction. So there's a few scenarios, and this comes from a piece written by Chantal Hébert a couple of weekends ago in the Toronto Star, but she points out that this is politically the riskiest pipeline to approve, and for them it's unfortunate that it's the first one up for approval.
And so there's another pipeline, Keystone, which we hear about in, say, the American press.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Alberta to, I guess, the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, and it's mostly built. There's already a large network of pipelines, including ones run by Enbridge and TransCanada, that go across the border. The reason why the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline has been delayed for all these years is because it requires presidential approval, because it crosses an international boundary border, and it's a new pipeline. So John Baird was in Ottawa this week chastising Barack Obama and telling him that it's time, you know, to make a decision. And you had a Democratic lawmaker who supports the pipeline who compared the time frame of the decision to how long it took to defeat Hitler, which, again, bringing the Nazis into the discussion, again,
Usually it doesn't work when you invoke.
It's polarizing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it advances the discussion. But Keystone XL is another option. There's also the Line 9 reversal. There's the Energy East pipeline proposal. There's the Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain proposal to Burnaby. And, you know, these are all options that the industry is looking at in addition to oil by rail and even more far-fetched proposals to take oil to, you know, Churchill, Manitoba, along a more northern route, or even up to the Arctic Circle. So there's, you know, there's no shortage of ideas about how to move this oil and where. Some of them obviously riskier than others, and the whole idea of having supertankers exiting the Douglas Channel out of Kitimat is the one that has attracted the most political opposition and the most grassroots opposition in BC. So that's why it's attracted attention, but it's also why the Harper government cabinet might take this one a little bit carefully.
Now, the premier in the last election campaign was talking about LNG.
Mm-hmm.
That's different altogether.
Mm-hmm.
She's for that. Mm-hmm. And so how close are we to, say, extracting that and exporting that?
Well, it's hard to say. There have been some investment announcements, specifically by a big Malaysian gas company, but there's nobody who's really stepped forward and signed on the dotted line, as it were, to build these LNG trains, the big terminals where they would cool the gas and liquefy it for shipping. So the technology is there, but we're in an interesting sort of arms race, and it's, you know, whenever it comes to commodity pricing, we're in a race to the bottom with other producers who might be able to access cheaper labor or lowered transport times. And ultimately, Christy Clark's revenue projections from LNG depend on a very optimistic outlook for the natural gas market in the next few years, which doesn't take into account the fact that Russia, which has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, has already got one LNG terminal built on the Pacific, and they're building another one. Australia is building 7 at once.
Yeah.
And so when you have Russian companies that operate according to Russian environmental standards and pay Russian taxes and Russian wages, that doesn't look so good for workers in BC to try to compete with that pricing-wise. Factor in the agreement between Russia and China to build a pipeline to transport natural gas without even using the tankers, and you have a scenario where the price could drop again, and the concessions that the BC government would have to make to natural gas companies in order to attract that investment, the kind of tax revenue that we would forego in order to seal those deals, could put our revenue projections far below what she campaigned on. And indeed, most independent economists say that, you know, this will probably happen, but it's not going to be the way that it was described in the Liberal campaign.
So when the media reports that what she says, especially when it's either we do this or we don't have schools or we don't have health care.
Yeah.
You wrote something on your blog, quite thoughtful, I thought, this obviously frustrates you in terms of the arguments that she's using. And I'm wondering, does that extend to, say, how the media's reported that angle?
Yeah. Well, okay, a moment ago we talked about how the media looks for polarizing subjects and looks for extreme viewpoints in order to, you know, generate interest in the coverage. Another thing that just happens as a consequence of cuts in newsrooms and the 24-hour news cycle is that resources are slim and people go for the easiest framing. It's not out of laziness, it's just, you know, resource constraints in newsrooms. And so if you've got a politician with a lot of very heavily focus grouped, you know, messaging behind her saying, this is a choice between increasing the pace of natural gas extraction or, you know, your grandma going hungry and cold in the dark. Obviously, that's a compelling frame. You know, it gets people emotional. And what you have is a lot of reporters who simply report what she says without challenging the basic rhetorical structure or the facts behind those assertions. And I don't think that it is true that you either you know, frack northeastern BC and get the LNG industry off the ground as fast as you possibly can, or else the whole society falls apart. And if it does, then that's due to mismanagement on another level. If that's your only option, if that's really the only way you've left yourself to fund a government, then that's just gross incompetence. You shouldn't have one industry, you know, trying to pull the whole rest of the province behind it. And certainly that's not the case now. LNG is, well, even natural gas is a tiny proportion of our GDP in BC.
So where are you in all of this? I mean, are you opposed to Northern Gateway? Are you opposed to fracking for LNG?
You know, I think I'm in favor of whatever it is the British Columbians decide, and I want that discussion to be full and rigorous and well-informed.
So do you feel then that British Columbians aren't as informed as they should be?
I think that we're ill-served by our politicians who simplify and in some cases skew the discussion, and I think that our media doesn't always do what it could to challenge those framings and to challenge the industry and to apply the same rigorous standards to everybody who's participating in the debate. There's a lot of focus on the environmentalists and what their motivations might be. Nobody's come forward with a compelling explanation of why it is that the CIA or the American oil companies or whatever it is that's supposed to be behind this conspiracy to keep Canadian oil landlocked. I've never heard it explained in any credible way or backed up by any of the foundations or the refineries that are supposedly involved in backing this campaign. So there's a lot of scrutiny put on the funding that goes to the opponents, but it's tiny in proportion to the funding behind the people proposing these projects who are advertising, during every hockey game. And I think that in that sort of discussion sphere, the average British Columbian doesn't know who to believe and is often forced into making decisions that I think place us in a position of having to make a false choice. So ultimately, though, I mean, I trust British Columbians in the long run to inform themselves about these issues and to make a reasoned decision. I can't say that, I don't think my personal opinions are actually as relevant to the decisions on these big projects. It's really something that's going to have to be decided by the people of BC. What gets me annoyed is when you have a federal government that refuses to take the opinions of British Columbians into consideration, or you have companies that, disregard or try to discredit citizens who speak out on these issues. And that, I think, is an unhealthy way to make major decisions about how our society is going to run for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
So when we see polling saying that they're in favor of it...
Well, it depends how you ask the question.
Yeah, okay. Now, in terms of, you've talked about what the media, what the challenges of that the media has in terms of resources and the sort. Mm-hmm. How do we make the media better, say? And I'm asking this as a media consumer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where it starts, and I think, from having worked in newsrooms, you don't know how powerful it is to get a phone call from an intelligent, reasonable listener saying, I listened to your coverage of this, and I wondered why you didn't have this voice or this perspective, and I wondered, whether you really should have given so-and-so as much airtime as you did, and that kind of direct feedback from the people who are most invested in consuming those media products, I think, has a lot to do with how the reporters approach the story the next time around. And so letters to your editor, calls to the newsroom are totally effective. And, choosing where to put your time and your web traffic and your attention and choosing outlets that you feel give, a more reasonable variety of perspectives is another way you can sort of vote with your wallet or with your eyeballs online.
Do you think we understand how this will change life in the province if all of this, all of these proposals come to pass? I live in Vancouver. How would, say, life for me change?
Well, in the case, we're most affected by the Trans Mountain pipeline proposal, which would put a new 36-inch pipe under the Fraser River all the way along through the Fraser Valley, and that would pop out at the Westridge Marine Terminal, which is 3 kilometers from my grandma's house, so it affects my family. And they're going to expand that terminal under the proposal, and there would be more than an oil tanker a day leaving through Burrard Inlet and out, past the Gulf Islands and Victoria, 400 a year. So that increases the risk of a spill, certainly. What that risk is hard to calculate. But when you ramp up that kind of traffic, then there are all kinds of effects that have been well documented, on marine mammals, on spill risk. So in the sense that, you increase the probability of an accident, we're all affected. But there's also just the fact that even if the pipeline never spills or the oil tankers never run aground, it starts to change the Canadian economy. And there are winners and losers, and there are people who will benefit and there are people who won't. And so that's something that some very mainstream economists have been pointing out, but their voices are drowned out by people who say, you know, building these pipelines is good for everyone. That's just not true. It's definitely good for the oil producers to get a higher price for their product, you know, and it means that there will be higher wages in extraction and more investment in the oil sands. But is that good for every sector of the Canadian economy? Is that good for people in manufacturing or refining, tourism, commercial fisheries, finance, real estate? There's lots of sectors that are going to be affected by the increased spill risk and by the higher price of Canadian crude. And as we see, every time the dollar goes up and down, there are winners and losers. So the question you have to ask yourself in BC is, does this benefit me more than the increased risk that I have to carry as a British Columbian, as a taxpayer who will be on the hook for spills, as somebody whose real estate values might go down, as somebody who, you know, who might be placed eventually at some health risk? I think that it's really much more interesting to look at the economics of these projects, because obviously none of us wants to deal with the worst case scenario, and oil spills are not in the interests of the companies that are proposing these projects either. It's not like they're, you know,
hoping for
evil
maniacs
who want to pollute the environment. Yeah. This is bad for them, and they don't want to lose product, let alone have to pay to clean it up. So it's really, to me, less about, you know, the poor sea otters who might hypothetically be threatened down the line. I think that's, you know, in some cases an unacceptable risk, but you also have to look at how it affects normal people, even if the pipeline doesn't pop or the tankers don't spill.
Yeah. We have an NDP. The BC NDP. They're going to be choosing a new leader sometime this year. I think later in the spring. There are municipal elections in British Columbia in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think these things that we've been talking about in the last few minutes? Do you think those will play a part in how those electoral races pan out?
Yeah, a major role. The Kinder Morgan proposal is already made its way into the discussion around both the next BC NDP leader and the municipal election. Starting with the municipal election, there was a motion that went to council just before Christmas, you know, approving city staff to apply for intervener status in the National Energy Board hearings around the Kinder Morgan proposal, and opposing that proposal on some very specific grounds. Now, that was a motion that was brought forward by Gregor Robertson. There were two councillors from the nonpartisan association who wanted to amend the resolution or to vote it down. But then 777 citizens either submitted letters of comment or showed up at City Hall to speak on this, and they were unanimously opposed to the Kinder Morgan expansion and in favor of Vancouver going to bat for residents, business owners, and property owners here in Vancouver. So the NPA backed off, and that means that as we head into the next municipal election, all the parties on council voted with this motion, and all the parties are on record as being opposed to the Kinder Morgan proposal. So that's definitely changed the landscape of the municipal election. At the provincial level, you had Adrian Dix make a decision on Earth Day just before the election, mm-hmm. that there's this persistent story around how that cost him the election. Well, that's... the evidence that I've seen doesn't suggest that's true. The polling that was conducted directly after Adrian Dix decided that he would oppose the Kinder Morgan pipeline actually showed that it gave him a bump, and it helped him solidify his lead and take voters away from both the Liberals and the Greens. So they lost for many reasons, but the people that are now looking at running to replace Adrian Dix do not necessarily subscribe to this story that opposing Kinder Morgan cost them the election. And I know of the candidates who are seriously thinking of running, you have David Eby, Mike Farnworth, and Kennedy Stewart, who's currently the MP in Burnaby Douglas, which is where the Westridge Terminal is, and he's the person who's helping coordinate citizen response and engagement in the National Energy Board process, because they've told him they don't want it in their neighborhood. So if you have Kennedy Stewart in the NDP leadership race, pipelines and tankers are going to be a big part of the discussion.
So this is a critical time, isn't it, in our sort of our culture and our political culture, at least in terms of decisions that have to be made shortly.
Put it this way: if we get it wrong, yeah. the consequences will affect everybody, and they will resonate for generations to come. Based on my own upbringing, my experience, what I've read, and my own values, I've come to a decision personally, and I would say that. These projects do not benefit me more than you know, the risks that they subject me and my kids to. But that's a personal decision that every British Columbian has to make at a certain point. And I think the real challenge is going to be to make sure that the federal government respects that decision. And, you know, you look at the opposition that's been built already to these projects, and it's really hard to see how they could, in good conscience, force this through a province that doesn't want, specifically the two oil sands pipelines. I don't really know how it's going to go, but I think that if we get this wrong, we will deal with the consequences for a long, long time to come. But if we get it right, it could be a turning point. It could be a place to, you know, deal with the most, frankly, extreme proposals that we've seen yet from energy companies in this part of the world, and maybe turn back the tide and work on stuff that people in British Columbia have clearly said that they favor, like alternative energy, renewable energy, green jobs, efficiency, social justice, all the other things that we have to deal with that are on hold right now while we go through this massive debate over these pipelines.
Now, I'm a big fan of Deprogram. The website that you have, you guys commit satire, as I like to say.
Yeah.
How's that going, and what can we expect from it in the next little while?
Well, there's a few ideas being tossed around. The main problem is time. That's sort of our side project.
And, yeah, you guys have jobs and things like that to do, right? Yeah.
Lately, my spare time has really gone towards trying to tackle and analyze a lot of the material coming out of the debate around these pipeline and tanker projects, because there's a vast volume of editorial being written and political rhetoric that's sort of cascading over us every time we open the newspaper or turn on the radio, and I think that there need to be some people looking at the aggregate and looking for the patterns and trying to debunk the inaccuracies and look seriously at some of the rhetorical tools that have been used lately by politicians on both sides of the debate. So I think I feel drawn to that, and it's slightly more serious work. But you know, I'm certainly not opposed to turning some of it into satire if I think that's the most effective way to tackle an issue or bring attention to something that somebody said. It's just a question of where you put your time and what you think is the most effective way to advance the discussion.
Did you wish you'd done more on the Rob Ford thing in the last several weeks when that exploded?
You know, what's funny is we made a little video about Rob Ford months and months and months ago.
Yeah.
And if you look at the sort of curve of the viewership, it's got over 100,000 views now, but it just sort of hovered around maybe 10,000 for months. And then when he admitted to actually smoking crack, the graph just spikes and you see, you know, 100,000 people discovered the video. So that was sort of a gift that kept on giving. I think there's a lot of good satirists working on Rob Ford right now, and I think there's a lot of talk show hosts and comedians who are gonna, you know, make us laugh for months and years to come with their Rob Ford material. So I don't know if I am needed in that particular discussion right now.
Well, I appreciate you coming in to do this. This has enlightened me a little bit in terms of all these issues that we're reading about, listening about on the radio and watching on television. I mean, I tend to think that I'm I consume media, say, a little more than the average person, but, you know, there are gaps and there are things that I don't understand, and you've certainly pointed me in the direction of things that I need to look into further. So thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Cool, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Kindagata.com is the website for more. Deprogram.com as well. Kindagata joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.